He's the host of the politics show at BCFM, thisweek.org.uk, and he's the man to go to if you want to learn about all things Bilderberg, and you've got to know about Bilderberg, you know, entry level. If you want to introduce somebody to secret societies in the Bilderberg group, Bilderberg.org, Tony Gosling, terrific guy, former BBC journalist, joins me live on the line from Bristol now. Tony, welcome.
It's funny that I'm a former BBC journalist, Richie, isn't it? Since I was going on about the Bilderbergs.
Since you were going on about the Bilderbergs. And the newspapers are full of stories today about Nicky Morgan, the culture secretary, advocating the abolition of the licence fee and using quotes from people like Andrew Marr, who say that the BBC is now just a biased liberal organisation full of young people, full of gay and lesbian people, and, you know, anti-Brexit and all the rest of it. Interesting times. Do you see that happening, Tony, the abolition of the TV licence?
Well, I think it actually would be a pity, which is a strange thing to say. Let's just think about, I mean, the way media works is basically, it's like a factory. And it's easy for someone to buy up a factory. Very, very simple for a banker to just, you know, press a button, make up £1 billion, dollars, euros, whatever, and buy it up. You can't do that with the BBC, and we've, you know, we've got a tremendous amount of bias there. But one thing, you know, I really have to say, is that certainly in the regions, the BBC is basically the only media that listens to anything to do with what ordinary people think. I mean, I think network BBC, that's, you know, radio, BBC 1, 2, 4. And, you know, Radio 1, 2, 3, 4, all that stuff, and 5 Live. They're very strictly biased and controlled, and they have been increasingly over the last, so we say, 20, 25 years. Almost every week we see a bit more bias. But, you know, the fact is that if the BBC was as biased as, say, the, you know, Sky, which is now owned by the US, we would have no independent media, broadcast media, at all in the country. So, I mean, it's horribly flawed, but I really do support the idea of a state-run broadcaster, because the thing is, if we elect a decent government at some point in the next 20, 30 years, everything could change at the BBC. It could really open up again and start to do proper journalism, which is by basically looking at both sides, looking at all angles on a story and reporting all angles. And we've seen, obviously, over the last 25 years, as I said, very, very little of that, on all sorts of issues, like climate change, the causes of climate change, what action is needed over climate change, the whole sort of discussion and debate over spirituality, creation versus evolution, whether Muslims were behind 9/11 and 7/7 or not, whether Iran sponsors all Middle East terror, whether changing your sex is good or normal, you know, whether there's a rule of law for banksters, whether, you know, Thomas Cook just accidentally collapsed, or whether there were massive bets going on to say that it would collapse and people made a lot of money out of that collapse. You know, the British Army in Ireland, whether those people should be prosecuted, the whole thing of the rule of law, we get absolutely no real balance at a national level on any of those subjects. But that's not the BBC, just the BBC. That's everybody. That's ITN, that's Sky, you know, ITN do ITV News and Channel 4 News. And almost all the broadcast media in this country is saying those things. And the BBC, you know, at some point in the future could become basically like when I arrived, you know, back in 1989 when I started working there, it was absolutely, you know, everything that they did, at least there was an attempt to get both sides. For example, the first Gulf War. We got a guy on Greater London Radio, which goes out to all the Londoners, who was a supporter of Saddam Hussein. If you can imagine that sort of thing happening now, you know, say we, you know, we declare war on Afghanistan and we get somebody on who's, you know, pro-Afghanistan, it would just simply wouldn't happen now. It's become a propaganda service, but, you know, it's flawed, but I still think that it's got a role, and particularly in the regions, you know, outside London, Manchester, Scotland, Wales, you know, the West Country where I am, you do get some really actually very good reporting.
Tony, it wouldn't be so necessary in the regions if the government had prevented companies like Global and Bauer buying up every regional commercial radio station in the country, because those old radio stations, and that's where I began, those radio stations, every one of them had a mid-morning talk programme, and it was produced and presented by people whom, you know, were, as you described, desperately keen to get both sides of every story. But since Global and Bauer and others came in, none of those radio stations now have got any mid-morning talk programmes. They're music-driven shows, with the only talk show outside of BBC Radio in the country now being LBC and Talk Radio. So I hear what you're saying, and I do agree with you. But if it wasn't for the death of plurality in this country through, again, massive corporations buying the local commercial stations, we wouldn't maybe be in the mess that we're in, or it wouldn't be as noticeable. What do you think?
Well, the big privatiser, okay, so obviously Margaret Thatcher started the ball rolling, the snowball. The big privatiser is a certain chap. Well, you know, he is basically the high priest of privatisation and always has been in the Conservative Party, and obviously listened to by the Blairites in the Labour Party, the neocon Labour Party, New Labour, and that lot, is a certain chap called Oliver Letwin.
Yeah.
And he obviously has been very, very significant since this whole Brexit parliamentary process, which shouldn't really be happening, actually. It's only this Gina Miller that's forced it to happen. It should be, people forget this, treaties like this should be negotiated directly by the government without Parliament having any say in it, because that's the way treaties have always worked. And in fact, even with the Lisbon Treaty, they changed it to become the EU Constitution so that it would have to be, or it would be less likely to be voted on. Then they called it the Lisbon Treaty, so that it wouldn't have to be voted on. So, you know, this is something which government should be able to just get on and organise and come back to Parliament and say, we've done it. So get one vote in Parliament, like we had with the Article 50 vote, and then just get on with it. But we've had this ridiculous engagement of Parliament with every little line in the treaty, which, of course, is totally impractical. It just doesn't work. So that's, I suppose, why we are where we are with all this. We're stuck in the mud, basically, with Parliament, with the Brexit business. But Letwin has played a very, very key role, as anyone who looks at it can see. He is a former employee. I mean, basically, he's just an agent of N.M. Rothschild and Sons in the Conservative Party. He's a former employee of Jacob Rothschild and N.M. Rothschild. And we know that these are some of the most powerful bankers in the City of London. And probably the organisation with one of the widest scopes over the centuries that's been looking to bring power to itself, aggrandise power, and take power over governments, over our free press, buying it up, you know, involved in influencing the media and our democratic process over the centuries. And it's no surprise to me to see him doing this amendment on Saturday, which has now meant, as we've heard today, that Burko has thrown out any possibility of even debating Boris's deal, which seems to me like they're being set up for a no deal. So, we've got Juncker is supposed to be leaving on the 31st and a new commission coming in on the 1st of November. But that's not happening because a bunch of the commissioners who've been sponsored by Macron, etc., the MEPs have said, we're not having these commissioners because there's financial irregularities. There's a whole load of the new commission, even the senior people, who have financial irregularities, including, of course, although she's not active commissioner, she's probably more powerful. That's the head of the European Central Bank, Christine Lagarde, with her conviction for fraud, you know, which she didn't go to jail for. Amazingly, she managed to, skip jail on that one. So we've got a whole bunch of fraudsters that they're trying to put in charge of Europe at the EU, the commissioners, and the MEPs have thrown it out. So it means that Juncker has got to stay on until the end of November, at least, in order to actually get a commission in place to take over. But Juncker, that's a really important point, is Juncker really wants to get Brexit done with. So I don't think, Richie, he's even interested in leaving anything for the new commission to deal with. He wants it finished. And when he leaves, he's going to say, well, everyone, nobody has to deal with my toxic legacy of Brexit after I'm gone. So we could well be seeing, no extension from the EU and what they call a crash out. It's amazing how, you know, news services all over the world say crashing out without a deal. Well, why is it crashing out? All it is we're leaving with no legal ties to the EU anymore. No European Court of Justice, none of that. We're going to start rebuilding our trade relations with the EU. And also, of course, there's going to be a transition agreement anyway. So it will be a nice, smooth transition. I think that's what's going to happen, because it seems to me that Letwin has been part of an operation to deliberately stop Parliament voting for this deal, so we have a no deal on the 31st.
I don't agree. I think they will grant an extension. I think there isn't anything...
Well, give us your take, yeah.
Yeah, I think they will. I think an extension is inevitable. I don't think there's anything that Boris Johnson can do about that. He might have asked them not to grant the extension, but they will grant the extension, I think, until, if not the end of January next year, maybe the end of April next year. I think it's inevitable. And this will end up in a general election cycle where the only issue on the table is Brexit. I think that's what is going to happen. I think you made a very good case for Jean-Claude Juncker's thinking, and you made a good argument, but I also think that very powerful forces, Tony, you know, behind the European Union, they can't afford, couldn't allow the United Kingdom to leave with no deal whatsoever. They couldn't, because the United...
Let me tell you why...
I didn't finish. Let me finish just briefly. I left you have a good say there. Let me just briefly finish, and then you just come right back in. The European Union, Tony, is a massive stepping stone on the way to a one-world government. There are forces behind the European Union, names and faces. People have never seen, they have no idea who they are. No country will ever be allowed to leave. This is why they've got all of these little stumbling blocks like Article 50, the two-year negotiation period. Then if you do leave, you've got the implementation period to give plenty of time for a new government to come in. They're just not going to let us tea. So I'll tell you what I think, and then you have the floor again. There will be an extension granted by the European Union, and that will pave the way then for an election. You think you might be running out of time for an election now, but I wouldn't be surprised if we had one in November. Go ahead.
Well, look, I think the one world government is dead in the water, Richie. It was certainly looking feasible up until around about 2000 when Putin took over. But he's really made sure that Russia is a very powerful independent force in the world. And in a way, it's sort of a balancing force between China and the West.
Yeah.
So I think they may... the only thing I think that the New World Order, the oligarchy, the elite, whatever you want to call them in the West here, the owners of our country, of our land, of our capital, the only thing I think that they can really try and do now is to force a war with China in order to try and win that and dominate. That's their only option, I think. And if Britain does leave, they can feel satisfied by kicking us in the short and curlies and by destroying the pound. By destroying the pound, they'll make it clear this is what happens if you leave our club. And we may even be in a situation where in a few years down the line with, say, Corbyn in power or whatever, that we're begging to come back to the EU again.
You might be right, Tony. We're going to have to wait and see. Obviously, the next few days are going to be fascinating. I mean, it's the 21st today. In 10 days' time, the country is supposed to be leaving. But look, it's important to point out as well, the withdrawal agreement negotiated by Johnson and his team is worse than what May presented. And it isn't any deal, of course. People don't understand this. That agreement with the European Union is a divorce agreement. It is not a deal, as you said yourself a minute ago. It's not a deal on future trading terms. It's not a deal on movement of people. It's not a deal on fisheries. It isn't, and people don't understand that. It's. I don't know whether they deliberately complicate this for people in the media or not. I don't know, but it's going to be frantic over the next few days. I have no doubt about that. And look, I take your point on board about the one world government maybe being dead in the water. And I understand the reasoning behind what you said, and I think you've got a good point there. But look, speaking about conflicts with China, speaking with conflicts about with Russia, you've got Guy Verhofstadt and senior German members of the European Parliament constantly tweeting, saying things like, Tony, well, this is proof that we need a European army. The Americans have screwed up Syria. We need a European army to deal with this. Russia is encroaching. We need a European army. These are the arguments they're making to keep the UK inside the European Union. So some future conflict with Russia and China, maybe, but with the European Union, Tony, central to that conflict, maybe.
Well, yeah, but you remember, we've got NATO in the background still, also based in Brussels, where, I mean, if anything was to happen, you'd almost certainly find Britain in lockstep with the Europeans and with the US in a military way. But we've got to keep a very close eye on this whole European Defence Union, because that's come in since we had the referendum. Ursula von der Leyen, the new president of Europe, and, you know, they don't like to call them that on the mainstream news, but that's what they were 4 or 5 years ago. They were saying, oh, we can now call them the president of Europe. Now the EU is, you know, fully fledged. And she is going to be the new president of Europe, taking over from Juncker, of course, not elected, appointed. But I think that her mission is definitely going to be to unite the armed forces. And I think this is one of the reasons we've had this whole Brexit business over here, is because our armed forces just simply do not want to be under the command of a foreign general. And they don't want to put, you know, people from Britain under their command. And that's actually, I think, probably what's precipitated this whole business, although you won't read that in a Daily Telegraph. No. It's almost written between the lines. So I think that's effectively what's going on with it. And I would be very surprised if we do have an extension or anything like that, Richie, honestly. I mean, we'll see what happens. Because I think they've decided someone needs to be made an example of, whether it was Greece or Italy or Spain. I mean, Catalonia, we haven't mentioned that whole business down there is horrific. Locking up politicians for actually doing what they said they'd do. I mean, God, our politicians half the time don't say what they say they do, and they get off scot-free. But in Catalonia, when they do what they've said at before a referendum or election, then they get locked up for it. Unbelievable.
Yeah, that's a crazy situation. I spent many years in Spain living there. I understand a little bit about the history of that. What Catalonia is, what it means. I do think, though, not to dwell on this today, because I want to get into diversity with you, because there's some funny stories, and I think there's something a bit deeper going on with the diversity stories in the media. But on the Catalan thing, you know, Tony, look, I agree with you. I'm not going to disagree with anything that you've said, but I think Brussels, I think the European Union, and those who prop it up, you know, the main players in Europe, they love this. They want to see states break up. They want to see more and more independence granted within countries, because they mop it up. They wanted Scotland to leave the Union here, to leave the United Kingdom, because the jocks were going to go, well, we'll leave the UK, but we'll then form a very close relationship with the European Union. And I think there is an element in Brussels that loves what's happening in Catalonia. They love it, because they just, well, this is just another state for us. What do you think?
No, I don't agree.
You don't agree, no.
But I can see that one of the things they do like about it is it's a great excuse to bring in a police state.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's what they want all over the place. I mean, what's happened to Julian Assange? I mean, just almost every day I think about this guy. You know, he's actually probably the bravest, most effective investigative journalist we've had for the last 10, 15 years in the West. And so he's not actually done anything wrong, but he's sitting rotting in jail. And we get almost nothing from the hundreds of well-paid staff journalists in this country. We should be screaming this from the rooftops. We don't want to suggest what we do to investigative journalists, stick them in jail when they haven't actually done anything wrong, and then we just turn the other way and forget about it.
You know, Tony, you couldn't have put that any better. If you're working for The Guardian, The Telegraph, whatever, the iPaper, whatever the bloody hell, your whole life is invested in what's happening to Julian Assange. Because it could be you in 5 years' time, or 10 years' time. You might publish something that's inconvenient for the government or for some other authority. And before you know it, your laptop's been taken, your computer's been taken. Jesus, Tony, look what's happening in Australia. The national newspapers in Australia this morning printed their Monday morning editions with their front pages redacted. Redacted to protest against the police in Australia coming after whistleblowers in the media and confiscating computers from newsrooms in Australia. Jesus, people think we live in a free world. These countries were so virtuous. England, Australia, America were so good and everybody else is so bad. In Australia this morning, the national press went to print with redacted front pages in protest at the tyranny in their country. Crazy.
Well, at least the owners and the editors are wanting to expose this problem. The thing that worries me is here in the UK that we seem to have pliable, compliant editors who, if someone from the military phones them up in the evening and says, well, actually, we hear you're going to be printing this story, we'd rather you didn't, they just simply say, yes, sir, we won't be printing that.
Have you got an example of that, first of all, Tony Gosling is our guest this week at org.uk. A rare breed of journalist is Tony, sadly, today. And I mean that sincerely. A rare breed. Can you give us, because I know you've got one or two examples, in the recent past where the military, in one guise or another, has asked or tried to compel the press in this country not to print something. Give us an example.
Well, I mean, the most clear and obvious one is over the Skripal case, yeah. You know, the Salisbury so-called poisoning, which now looks as if, as I said the previous time I spoke to you, as if this Novichok was actually a fake chemical, potentially. There are people looking into this still, trying to stand the story up, but it could be even a fake chemical that which was put out by the Russian intelligence just to flush out who it was that was passing secrets to the West, this being a bogus secret, so they could see if the West had that secret, that it would have come through a particular route, and then they could root out who'd done it. So that was the D-notice on Pablo Miller, who was one of the people involved in all that. And, of course, he was also involved, Miller was also involved in the Litvinenko case. And what the D-notice said was, OK, we don't want any connection, we don't want any mention of Miller in any of the papers. And you know what? They did exactly what they wanted to, and there was very little. Because it started to bubble up in a couple of newspapers, and the military just closed that story down. And we've heard very little of it since in any other press. So there's a perfect example of just how pliable and compliant our press is. I'd love to see, you know, the sort of thing that, you know, these real debates, the stuff I was talking about kind of at the start there, where you've got some of the real big issues of our time, like, is climate change really man-made? Let's see a decent hour and a half documentary on the BBC about it. Is it man-made or not? With all the main people like Piers Corbyn, you can have all your people from the climate science departments arguing with him, and let the listeners decide. We don't want to be told what to think by the BBC or anybody else.
I'll never forget a couple of years ago, because I did a programme on it, and in fact I invited Piers and he came on. Piers Corbyn was on the Big Questions with Nicky Campbell on Sunday morning 2 years ago on the BBC. And they had Piers on his own. And they had a woman from Friends of the Earth who's not a scientist. They had one of the Green Party guys. I should know his name. He's recently been a co-leader of the Green Party. Anyway, he was on as well. And not a scientist. And at one stage, Nicky Campbell, he had been given less time to Piers Corbyn. And Piers Corbyn was given the microphone, and Piers made a very salient point about CO2 levels in the atmosphere. And I swear to God, and I have the clip, I can play it again later, tomorrow, Nicky Campbell looked at the Friends of the Earth woman and the Green Party guy and said, "You see, this is what you have to put up with." I'm going to swear, Tony, what the fuck? I would have been fired for that. I would have been fired for that in my time in commercial radio. Did you really do
that?
Thing
is, by buying up these radio networks and TV networks, the owners believe that it just gives them the right to just transmit through those networks what they think. And, you know, having met some of these Bilderbergers, Richie, they're not nice people, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
You know, they have decided what is going to happen. They own our world. And they've decided what's going to happen with it. And if you, I mean, for example, I just brought up the word Brexit with Jacob Wallenberg, who's the chief banker of Sweden. And he just looked at me as if his hackles went up. He said, "Get out of here. You're harassing me." No chance of a discussion. So that's the mentality we've got in so much of our mainstream media.
Right
now.
Across the media.
Our mass media is they have decided how things are. The people they employ are just there to regurgitate what the owners and the top editors think. And this is a pretty, you know, scary world, actually. It means we're getting this problem. I mean, if you go to the pharmaceutical industry, I know you probably didn't want to talk about that, but this is really important. The pharmaceutical industry is killing people. I think last week it was in the news, a pill called Zantac by GlaxoSmithKline,
yes.
Which is used for heartburn. It's been on the market for nearly 10 years. 10 years of people taking this pill day after day after day after day, and then they find out a couple of weeks ago or 10 days ago that it's carcinogenic. It's taken off the market with hardly a whisper.
Tony,
and you expect us to take your vaccinations. You know, but what we're basically getting is we're getting marketing transmitted as if it's science with no questioning through the mass media. I think we've got to be, you know, we have seen a great fall off in the number of vaccinations for young kids. Well, that's partly because the enormous increase where you're having to have three injections all at once or five injections all at once for newborn children, and partly because the mums and the dads are getting wise to this. This is potentially toxic stuff you're putting into my child, and I'm not having it. And yet they say, oh dear, you know, it's the anti-vaxxers. Well, hang on a minute. I've had vaccinations. I just don't want to have five all at once, because I remember meeting a guy who could hardly speak. He was a victim of Gulf War syndrome, and he'd had a load of injections all at once back in the 1990s.
Yeah, and I've interviewed women in America. One amazing woman called Alyssa Nethery, whose young baby boy was given 11 vaccinations in one day and died 3 days later. And they have yet to accept responsibility or culpability for that. Tony Gosling is our guest. I'm going to read a couple of tweets. John says, great point by Tony. Putin has thrown a spanner in the works. However, says John, I don't believe the one world government has gone away, he says. Maybe they're focused on new ways of achieving it. Instead of forcing 1984 on us, they're allowing us to enslave ourselves by our own narcissism, brave new world style. But great point by Tony, says John. And Sharon Gale is a very special woman and a friend of mine on the south coast here in the UK. Sharon's own story was national news back in the early 2000s. Sharon's child was kidnapped by the state based on risk of future emotional harm. And her story is a cautionary tale for every parent in this country. I've never heard a story like it. I have all the documentation. I've got it all here. I won't get into it. It's all on YouTube if you want to see it. My story, says Sharon, was told to be a no-go for all press and ITV. So was many other vaccine stories, all stitched up by the police in Hampshire. It boils my blood to this day. I'd like to jump into this, Tony. Tony Gosling, The Politics Show, one of the best programs on radio anywhere in the UK today. It really is, folks. Check it out. Thisweek.org.uk. Terrific presentation. Great content. You can't beat it. It's great stuff. Tony, I was reading this story. We used to laugh hard at these stories. Now maybe we shouldn't be laughing. So you've got Always, which makes sanitary products for women, and they have done for a long time, and any of us that's lucky enough to have a woman, and I do, we will see some of this stuff around from time to time. They've removed the symbol of Venus from their packaging because it might offend transgender people, and this is one of a thousand stories like this. You spoke to me about Victoria's Secret, you might get into that. What is this? Is this just a little bit of a fad? I don't mean the trans thing itself. There's always been trans people. But where they are being allowed, or some of them, to dictate to big corporations what they should and shouldn't do, is this going to pass or is it going to get worse, Tony? Because trans women, men who identify as women, can't have menstrual cycles, so Jesus effing Christ, therefore you shouldn't be using sanitary towels. But Always acquiesced and took the Venus symbol away. What's really going on, T?
Well, you know, I think it's about the destruction of the family. That's what it seems to me. The basic, you know, these are just facts to do with people's bodies that you can't really... there's a lot of people, I think that they might prefer to have been the opposite sex. But I honestly don't think it does them any good to try and change what sex they are. When it comes to this, to the Victoria's Secret story, I really laughed out loud when I saw that. They're saying basically that this high street chain, you know, we've seen so many other high street chains, and this is one that goes all over Europe as well, is having all sorts of trouble because they're not catering for transgender people enough, right? Well, I don't know if transgender people have some sort of super amazing spending power. Maybe they do, but I didn't know if they did. And of course, what's really happening here is that there is a problem on the high street with all shops, but they're blaming it on the fact that you're not transgender catering enough at Victoria's Secret. I just find this sort of news line, this sort of headline, laughable, because it's almost as if everything is being seen through this transgender prism. And, of course, it's actually not normal. And to a certain extent, I can understand why people might wish to offer services to help those who think that they're one sex but not another sex. I'm going quite careful how I phrase this because, you know, you I do understand that some people have a preference for one sex or another sex, but the idea that you can actually change your sex, I don't think it's actually doing the individuals doing it any good at all, Richie. But what it does do is it has a sort of toxic effect on the idea of the traditional family, family values, and those sorts of, you know, the idea that we should provide a nurturing, simple place that nature gave us for young children. That to me seems the best way to bring up kids. And of course, a lot of this leeches into the idea of pushing these values onto young kids, prepubescent kids at infant school, which I don't think is necessary and healthy. It really confuses these young kids. And it's fine an older, you know, once you reach the age of maturity, whatever, okay, but not the younger children. And I think most people would agree with that. You know, some people would say, well, you know, you're transgender phobic or something by saying it.
No.
I think, you know, kids really do need a steer at a younger age about sexuality. Otherwise, potentially, they can be confused and they could easily be, you know, the idea of bringing sexuality into a child's mind at too early an age can actually make them vulnerable to predators, predatory adults, for example. So we need to be a proper debate about this, which of course isn't happening, because anybody that says that, you know, counters an argument to a transgender argument is labelled as some kind of homophobic, transgender phobic, LGBT phobic or whatever. Arguments and discussions are there to be had, and I, you know, like to see more of that.
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny how hostile that is. I found myself being. I went looking for a story today about Rachel. I don't know if the surname is McKinnon. I'm terrible. It's the trans person who won, the trans woman who won the cycling race, and there's murder over that. The trans woman is actually an academic, but who races cycle bikes or whatever the bloody hell. And looking for more information on the story today, I found that I was blocked by the person on Twitter. Now look, I'm not important, it's not about me, but what it said to me was, even though I never had any contact with that person, it seems like that particular agenda is out looking for any opposition to it, because I would be opposing it. I'd be opposing trans women participating in female sports. I wouldn't want trans women using women's toilets. It seems like they're out looking for the opposition and blocking them on Twitter, because I've had no interaction with this Dr. Rachel McKinnon. But I would have been interested in interviewing the person about, you know, some of the things that they've said. Let me ask you this, T, and thanks for coming back in the program today. I want to ask you this. This is important as well, I think. RT.com ran a critical article on its website about the Guardian newspaper. The Guardian newspaper did an interesting little feature, kind of like one of those human interest stories, where they got some British children to try to complete some tasks using equipment and gear from, I don't know, 30, 40 years ago, to see would the kids be able to use the gadgets maybe that we used when we were younger. Sounds like the plan, right? Sounds like a decent article or just a bit of a throwaway entertaining piece to write or whatever. But anyway, they used... All the kids that were used were all ethnic minority children. And a writer for our team made a very good point about this. Wrote a very good article asking about, you know, the article, writing saying that the Guardian article wasn't about diversity. It was actually about could English kids do a task that, you know, we did when we were back in the 1970s or whatever. And it got me thinking, because they used six or seven children. They were all minority kids, fair enough. I'm watching the Man United match yesterday, Tony, against Liverpool. And Sky News, of course, over-eggs these matches. They give the most boring coverage before the game. You just want the game to bloody start and get on with the bloody game. But you've got these montages. They run these little films with a lovely soundtrack. And the presenter is saying it's the biggest game in British football and all of this. And all of the footage they're shown to is of black people wearing Liverpool and United gear. Of Asian people wearing Liverpool and United here. Honest to God, now Tony, I don't have a right wing or alternative right wing bone in my body. But I'm fair, and I listen to people. And I'm watching that, and I'm thinking, that's deliberate, that. There's something going on there. The vast majority of people...
Well, it might be...
Go on.
I mean, it might be simply that they want to encourage more people of ethnic minorities into the football world or whatever, or into sport, just to make people feel that it's for them. But anyway, it is a bit patronising. But this is about an equality agenda. Well, okay, so there is, of course, an enormous amount of importance in, you know, basically treating everybody equally. But you know what is lost in all of this is the horrific income inequality. So you've got people sleeping in shop doorways in Bristol. We've got something like 150, 200 of them. And we've got the super rich paying no tax at all. And, you know, we're talking about millionaires and billionaires paying zero tax. And yet you've got, see, this is what I think equality is really all about, is they're trying to get all sorts of, everyone interested in, and they're funding all sorts of things around racial equality, sexual equality, which is all well and good, but there's nothing around income inequality and nothing around horrific poverty which is thrust right in your face. And that, to me, is the real equality that we need to sort out in this, if we're going to make our world a better place.
It's the same
here. Make sure everybody has been treated decently, got a roof over their head, something to eat, and a glass of water. And then we can start to move on.
Listen, mate, I totally agree with that. We have a huge homeless problem in this city as well, and in the country. And I believe a country is a failed state if you've got people on the streets, nowhere to go, no food. But just finally, I want to just stay with the diversity thing and the positive discrimination thing. Isn't there a danger? And there's a guy called Frank Faraday, who's an academic, he's been on this program. There's a guy called Stuart Waiton, is an academic, who's been on this program. And they're not right-wing thinkers. And they say there is a danger, increasingly in this country particularly, whereby you are treating minority people and minority culture. You're favouring it over the majority culture, and you're seeing a huge problem develop out of that. Obviously a big divide and conquer problem, because the majority culture is like, well, people are bewildered as to what's going on, they're fighting back against it. And I think that area of research is very interesting. I can see it, and again, I'm not a conservative, I can see that. I can see minorities being protected, being afforded protection, being promoted, while at the same time, the majority is going the other way. Now, you probably won't agree with that. Final word to you.
Well, no, I don't really. I think, you know, it's absolutely fine to have events and things which are focused on racial minorities and all sorts of minorities, because, you know, what's happening in the wider world is there's a real attempt to get, I mean, the Tommy Robinsons and people like this, to get poor people fighting each other. You know, what we're seeing, I think, and this is one of the reasons I think that Halloween really could be Halloween this time, you know, with some sort of, you know, crash and attack on the pound. You know, we've got, as you said, I think the last time we spoke, Richie, a kind of social credit system behind the scenes, a secret one going on in Britain anyway. So this is to say anybody with a particular point of view can be quite secretly blacklisted, you know, and gotten out of the way, and the people who have other points of view can be promoted through the system. We, you know, think in the background, we've also got Hong Kong, we've got the riots going on there, other places in South America, in Argentina, Chile, and other parts of South America, we've got the street riots going on in Lebanon, we've got the Barcelona we mentioned earlier, we've got the Yellow Jackets, we've got this enormous thing of bringing all these Remain people into London. Now, I don't know about you, I got a thing through my door about a week ago saying free buses to go to London for the Remain thing.
No
and
way.
I'm also getting some. Yeah.
Did you? Wow.
So there's obviously money behind this. I would suggest possibly Soros money, Open Society Project money, which is certainly behind Extinction Rebellion, although they refuse to say how much money Soros has paid towards Extinction Rebellion. And what an insane protest on a tube train at Canning Town. Unbelievable, ridiculous, insane, to try and stop a tube train, which is the public transport we want to see, completely bonkers. So I think there's an attempt to destabilise, that's what I'm saying, right across the planet, actually. And that could be a precursor to something much bigger. We shall see.
I don't want to see more tubes. I want to see more Hummers and more Land Rovers on the road, Tony. That's what I want to see.
So you got shares in Humvee, have you?
No, I wish I did. No, but I get pissed off. I've got an old, I've got a diesel estate car. It's 7 or 8 years old, and it does 70 to the gallons. Great economy on the old diesel. I just get pissed off at people telling me you won't have your car in 10 years. I know in my bones that man-made CO2 is not warming the planet. It's not because I want to believe that. I know it's not happening. So I get pissed off when I'm told, you know, you got to use the tube, you got to use the bus. I don't mind that.
Well, you know...
Go on.
Basically, this is something I was thinking about the other day, is the enormous fights and battles we had in the 1970s and 1980s over coal. What we're seeing, of course, with the climate movement, again, is saying that your most Britain, your most plentiful coal supplies, use of energy available, and in fact, our technology is such that we could very easily run a very cheap railway system based on coal. I mean, they developed in the 1950s the most efficient and fastest coal-powered locomotive anywhere in the world, brilliantly engineered. But no, you can't have any coal at all. What I think is actually what we've got today is an enormous mass movement of ordinary people who are maybe partly deluded, but they're just backing up this attack on the coal industry that we saw from the multinational oil companies back in the 1970s and the 1980s, smashing the miners' strike and the miners' unions, etc. It links up with what's going on today, I think.
Yeah, I think it does, mate. Hey, listen, come back real soon, will you? Love having you on the programme, going over these issues. Tony Gosling can be heard at the Politics Show in Bristol. It really is kind of last man standing in radio in the UK today. It really is, mate. You know how much I think of the programme. This week at org.uk.
We did a bit on Prometheus on Friday, which was Boris Johnson's speech at the United Nations, and had a really good look at what is he channeling there. When he starts talking about Greek myths, the Greek myth of Prometheus bringing fire to mankind, what's he really saying? And I've come to the conclusion, actually, he's the real anti-Semite, because he's attacking the Torah and the Old Testament by going on about Prometheus. Anyway, you can have a look at that if you go on to thisweek.org.uk. And, I think a bit of a sideways, left-field take on it. But, you know, how about Boris as the main anti-Semite? Doing an anti-Semitic speech in the UN, Richie.
I'm going to have a listen. Tony, I always listen to the programme. I haven't heard Friday's episode. I'm going to have a listen to it later on for sure. Thisweek.org.uk, Tony Gosling. And if you want to know anything about Bilderberg, there's only one man to go to, one place to be, Bilderberg.org. Thanks, mate, for doing it on a Monday when you're busy. I appreciate that, Tony. Always love having you on, mate. And we'll speak soon.
Cheers, Richie. God bless. Bye-bye.
You too. The terrific Tony Gosling, live on the line to us there from Bristol. Top man, Prometheus, eh? Because I did see some of that speech, obviously. But Tony's analysis of that'll be fascinating, that. Thisweek.org.uk.